There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby. That's right. This man knows what's up.
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
And with that, let's get going here. A new year, and it's Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. Hey, I'm Sean. Easy to get in touch with the show as well at 251-343-0106. 251-343-0106 for a phone call or a text. Both work with that same number. And if you want to leave a talkback message, use the FM Talk 106.5 app. If you go there, right there on the front page of the app. If you don't have it yet, make that something you do here in the new year. Go ahead and grab the FM Talk 106.5 app. It's free. If you're an Apple user, go to, you know, if you're an iOS user, go to the App Store. If you're a Android user, go to Google Play. Either place, just look for our name, FMTALK1065. No point between the 6 and 5. Just drop the point. That's the point. Don't drop it. Drop the point. And you'll see our logo. That's us. Download the app. Of course, you can use it to stream and do all kind of stuff. But one of the features on there is that talkback feature where you'll see a microphone icon. You press that, lets you record a message, emails it to the show. All right. By the way, too, as we get started in all this, I just saw this pop up. According to Reuters right now, and we'll get the Maduros were in court today in New York and all that. We're going to lay all that stuff out here very, very shortly. But according to Reuters right now, under the state of emergency that was ordered by the Venezuelan government following the operation, which resulted in the successful capture of Nicolas Maduro, military and security forces are directed to immediately begin the national search and capture of everyone involved in the promotion or support for the armed attack by the United States. You know, we talk about the mission that happened there, and you can't, even with his, can I say, bad art, as bad arse as Delta Force is, right? That you had to have the intelligence, CIA obviously working with Delta Force, two groups you actually don't hear from a whole bunch, right? They don't do a lot of, like, getting media attention. Well, they get media attention, but they stay quiet. So the CIA working with Delta Force there. But they had to obviously have assets on the ground that were people they worked with, right? They had to have people that they had turned or that were already turned, giving the information, the layout of Maduro's safe house, all that kind of stuff. You know, who would be here on this guard duty at this point, and what did Maduro do at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and 4 o'clock in the afternoon and 3 in the morning, all that kind of stuff. So there are people that are helping. And now... they're at least this coming out here that they are searching out. So we're probably going to see now. What do we do? We're going to see them dragging people out of their homes, this, that, and the other. It's going to be, but yeah, that's just coming out now. The Venezuelan government, sans Maduro, saying they're a national search and capture of everyone involved in the promotion or support for the armed attack by the United States. So you can, I mean, obviously it's a socialist country dictatorship in a way. You know, it's a dictatorship because, I mean, Maduro stole the election. So you've got this situation where they're not already, and we're going to go through the unsealed document up in New York of the charges against the Maduros and more. And you'll see kind of how they were operating. It scares me for the people there in Venezuela, because do you think they're going to give them their day in court? They're going to say, no, you're an enemy of, you know, Venezuela, and get in the van. So, and by the way, too, on a lighter note, I don't know, and maybe Dalton saw, so the word is right now that a plane matching the description of the one that Lane Kiffin flies has been seen in Caracas. Did anybody? I don't know if it's confirmed. There's just Kiffin looking for a new job there. He may be running Venezuela before it's all said and done. All right. So what happened over the weekend? I know it's been discussed a lot, and we can get back to that. Dalton and Dan did a great job of breaking that down this morning. So about what's happened today, and Maduro and Mrs. Maduro have pled not guilty. Not guilty. So they came into court. Here's the latest here on, let's see. Oh, we got another story, too. This is coming out, too. The Colombian president is saying, come get me now. Which they got to be careful here, because Trump's already even looking at Greenland. And what's his name? Frederick Nielsen there in Greenland. It's probably cold for the mission right now, but we might have special operators going in to remove him as well. But yeah, so Maduro's in court. It says here, update, this is from CNN World. All right, fancier. It's like going to Epcot or something like that. It says, defiant Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, entered not guilty pleas in their first court appearance in New York after being captured in a U.S. military operation. The ousted leader, who faces drug and weapons charges, told the judge he's still the president of Venezuela and the couple is not seeking bail for now. Okay? So they're not guilty, they say. They're going to lawyer up here. So let's go through what the charges are against the Maduros. I thought this was interesting as they've unsealed what prosecutors have said. This is what is now finally coming out, right? This is what they are alleging. I mean, we've heard a whole bunch of it, but this is like in lawyer speak. All right, so we're looking at 25 years of what they're calling narco-terrorism, drug trafficking. And what I think is interesting in reading through this document from the prosecutors, it wasn't just... This is what I came back to making notes today. It wasn't good old-fashioned corruption, like on the edges. It was embedded corruption, right? It wasn't this person's being bought off or this person's being bought off. It is, this is how we do business. So prosecutors say what was happening behind the scenes is way more coordinated probably than many of us thought before. This is kind of my speak of what they said in these unsealed documents. They said for the last 20 years, Venezuelan government didn't just tolerate the drug dealing. The government took place in it, took a part in it, and profited from it. In other words, they didn't just turn a blind eye. Okay, they didn't just say, you know, all right, we'll let those drugs go out. I'm not saying, you know, you give me the money and I'm not going to have the enforcement come down there. It was a collab between the drug cartels and the government. This is the what they've released today. The government was a partner, not a third-party vendor, maybe, to this corruption, right? This is what they go on to say. The filing alleges government institutions were kind of sidestepped into helping traffickers. So they took Department of whatever in Venezuela, and I don't think they listed them here, but there were government institutions that they used how they could help. One may be for travel. One may be for military protection. One may be for, we'll get to this, the allegations of international travel and all that, how these were actual government agencies in Venezuela that weren't just on the take. They were kind of partnered up with the drug dealing. He said the setup had protections to put some distance in here, as I read through, between higher up Venezuelan officials. There were like some kind of, you know, one step removed, two step removed ideas in there to try to like say, well, you could have plausible denial in these things. All right. So it alleged that there was just one, maybe two levels of distance between them, but the government officials were not just turning a blind eye, they were working with them. Prosecutors named names in this, not just Maduro, but of course his wife, Celia Flores, Interior Minister D'Alessandro Cabello, former Interior Minister Ramon Chacin, Maduro's own son, Hector Flores, who is the leader of Tren de Aragua, he's named it as well. And the argument was it's not just good old-fashioned corruption, but I wrote this in my liner notes here. It was a co-op a co-op between the cartels and the government in Venezuela. And the charges, the prosecutors are framing the case centered in narco-terrorism conspiracy charge. And then on top of this, they didn't write this, but they add in a little cocaine importation conspiracy. On top of that, they have weapons charges. I thought that was odd. It stood out to me. Here's another country, failed or not. You know, what are we doing with weapons charges in this? And so weapons charges, including machine guns and what prosecutors call destructive devices. I'm going to guess explosives or something. I'm not sure. Prosecutors went on to say the weapons charges were important because it showed how the cartel and the government did enforcement. In this document, they go on to say Maduro partnered with international drug cartels designated as foreign terrorists by the U.S., including not just Venezuela, including Mexican cartels, the Sinaloa cartel, Los Zetas, and Colombian cartels, and their homeboys, Trinidad Aragua, there in Venezuela. So it shows that they're all working together. And here's how prosecutors in New York say the deal worked. The deal was in return for cover and protection. Top Venezuelan military got very wealthy. I think Jerry Carl said earlier, when you see all these generals are billionaires, I don't know if they're billionaires, but they seem to have made a lot of money. The way the Venezuelan military made their money is they provided the protection for the shipments as they moved north out of Venezuela, right? I still don't know how they get them exactly in one boat into the United States, but it's another story. So Venezuelan military, not just, once again, it goes back in this document, not just like turning a blind eye. They were like partners in it. Like, okay, here's what we're going to do. Like it was a mission, right? It wasn't just, I'm going to have the military turn the other way and not pay attention when you drive by. It's, we're going to have the military working along with you doing this. And it says, members of the military, a lot of these generals got rich, providing protection for the shipments. They also, in the documents, allege Maduro personally took actions to advance this as well. It goes back in the documents between 2006 through 2008, while Maduro then was acting as Venezuela's foreign minister. He's accused of selling passports. So here's, like, I like when we get specifics instead of just saying, oh, they're all bad guys. Specifics. They said Maduro would, at that point, he's foreign minister. He would sell passports to the cartel members, the drug traffickers. Then they would have this passport, and I guess Venezuelan passport, and maybe a government passport, because it let them move proceeds from drug trafficking under diplomatic cover. So when they're outside, you know, the diplomatic immunity and all that jazz, they had these where they could use diplomatic cover. They also go on and said Maduro green-lighted private aircraft to be flying back and forth from Mexico to Venezuela. No searches in Mexico, no searches in Venezuela. We'll get to the searches in Venezuela in a second because they were on a diplomatic mission. So these documents that Maduro, back when he was foreign minister, put out, gave the cartel members diplomatic immunity. Like they're doing the nation's work or whatever, so you can't stop them and search them. Pretty interesting. They went on and said, and the prosecution says, they laid out how the enforcement went as well. They said, this is what I was getting to. This is pretty interesting. They said, when bust would be made of cocaine, or what they said cocaine here, but maybe other drugs, but let's just say cocaine in Venezuela. So you've got a traffic stop or a drug bust, right, in Venezuela, like a Venezuelan person and Venezuelan police or whatever bust them. The cocaine, and maybe other drugs, but I think they said cocaine, was then returned to the cartels. So the cops, instead of doing the, you know, where they, I don't know if they do it. Remember, they used to burn all the drugs or something like that. Instead of doing something like that and destroying the drugs, the law enforcement, I guess under the direction of the higher-ups, would take the cocaine in this case and then return it to the cartels to sell again. Like a vendor's lien for this stuff or something. But yeah, they would. So there's some organization within law enforcement, I guess, around all parts of Venezuela. If they did it, so they were enforcing. I think it's interesting. The nuance is interesting. They were enforcing laws in Venezuela to not have drugs because drugs are bad, okay? So they'd make a bust. like, hey, you know, we busted you. This car, the guy had cocaine, or these people were dealing drugs here in Venezuela neighborhood. They'd make the bus. Police would then take the cocaine and give it back to the cartels. And I'm sure tell them, like, sell this out of the country. Don't sell it here. They had state-backed militias also that were in charge of and assigned to protect the shipments. So this is how the military gets into it as well. They would protect the shipments. They would be, like, I guess, the armed security for it. They would also, you're talking about spooky stuff, they were on to collect debts owed to the cartel. So if somebody didn't pay for the money or whatever, you know, like the theme of every Miami Vice when I was growing up, the person didn't have the money or whatever. Well, the quasi-military militias were sent to collect those debts. And anyone who threatened the business, those same militias would go in there and shut them down. Also, prosecutors alleging that Maduro and his wife oversaw enforcement actions. Okay, so with competitors, enforcement actions against competitors enforced with beatings and murders. And the Maduros, so the couple, at least according to what prosecutors are alleging, were paid directly for that, the protection operation. And I don't think they were doing, I don't think Celia and Nicholas were doing this, but people under their charge were doing the beatings and murders and then getting paid for it as well. So there's a little bit of what was laid out today. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's an eye-opener for sure for me watching this go down over the weekend. I was, you know, not glued to it. I was in a remote location, but I started thinking about this. So, and Jeff mentioned it a little bit earlier, talking about interventionism or not interventionism. Trump's on a roll. I mean, Nigeria, Iran, Venezuela, you know, going in other countries. And now I feared that so many times in our country we'll do something like this and it ends up we figure out how to get boots on the ground. There is some discussion on what they're going to do to get the oil under control there. Will there be U.S. boots on the ground? I mean, I think it's probably a jump ball right now, if not. Also, I started thinking about, you know, Trump's foreign policy. What is it going to look like in a textbook when we have the FAFO foreign policy? Like, kids will be studying one day, they'll be like, okay, President Trump, what was it? Was Monroe Doctrine? This is the FAFO foreign policy. Hey, teacher, what does FAFO stand for? Well, a lot going on. Also, coming up here in just a little bit, too, we'll get back. We'll get some text read here. But at 12:35 or so, my buddy J.R. Young from King Operating, the oil guy out of Texas that joins us on the show, he's going to talk about Venezuelan oil, oil markets, and all that going forward in 2026. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. All right, coming right back. More Midday Mobile just minutes away.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:26, FM Talk 106.5 in Midday Mobile. Oh, I did see this, too. They used the F-35 in the mission. At least that's what was coming out of the Pentagon. You know, the discussion of the F-35 fighters. Said the F-16, they could use the F-35s to avoid radar. They're pretty interesting. Be more. I'm sure there's going to be more debriefing on this going forward. Let's debrief from the text line here. First texter up, unnamed texter. By the way, 2026, give yourself a nickname on the text line. So, you know, first name or nickname or something like that. But this unnamed texter says, why was Maduro brought to New York instead of a more conservative jurisdiction? I think they go to New York because that's where the federal court that is the narco-terrorism, they have jurisdiction over the narco-terrorism, is that Southern District of New York. So it's like specifically that office, I think, that does this. So I think that's why New York. Let's see. B-Dark. What's up, B-Dark? Says, a bunch here. Let's see. I think all voting should be on paper, not on machines. Oh, back to my paper discussion. Yeah, I'm just... Jeff's going to be, Jeff and Todd Stacy and all of them are down there at the forestry conference and they ain't got any trees to sell. B-Dark says, hell yeah, tell Columbia we're coming. We need cheaper coffee. You know why the coffee is more expensive, though? I mean, not to upset everybody, but it's tariffed. Okay. B-Dark also says, when they're getting their where are they getting their lawyers from? Are they getting public defenders for lawyers? I don't know. I wouldn't think so. I think there's probably some money out there. I don't know if all their assets, if they can get. I don't know that. Let's see. David says partners in crime. I don't know what that one's from, but it says you and Rand Paul and Cameron Smith wanted to see the justice system do its work when it came to the Venezuelan drug boats. Yeah. Yep. Let's see. Jason says, Sean, what are your thoughts about the latest Massey rant? Seems like he won't be happy until he's in the minority again with a Democrat president. He can't be against everything. I don't know what the latest one was. Was it about? I mean, there's a Thomas Massey is consistent. That's why I appreciate him the way I appreciate Rand Paul. Their consistency. Now, here's the problem. Like, the people on the left that are coming out and dogging this out are not consistent, right? The Lord knows Fox News has all their interns working on get us every clip of, you know, Biden or Schumer or all these Democrats talking about narco state of Venezuela and the indictment against Maduro and all those things that happened. So they got no leg to stand on. But somebody like a Massey or a Paul, they're consistent. They're not pro-Venezuela, but they're also so pro-America that they're not for involving ourselves in other places. Does this turn into a... Remember, they're rounding up the people in Venezuela they thought might have helped the Americans right now. Do you think Venezuela becomes a Democrat country anytime soon? I hope so, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
At 12:35, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And we'll get back to the text line here shortly, but always a treat to get this guy on. Really do enjoy our conversations. J.R. Young from King Operating, a man that's taught me more in like one conversation about the oil business than I could have learned reading 10 books, although he's got books about it. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great, John. Thanks for having me on again. Appreciate you.
It's good, and we'll get back. Hey, happy New Year to you as well. And we'll get back to some domestic production here before we finish discussing it. But I think it was probably the last time you were on the show with me. We're talking about several things, but you brought up Venezuelan oil and what was going on there. And here we sit now with a sea change moment in Venezuela. Your thoughts as a as an oil guy? What do you think about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's news, right? I mean, it's news and. That guy's being transported here, and you know, Maduro. And I feel like that. What everybody's thinking is, okay, man, this is going to oversupply our United States addiction to oil or appetite, if you will. George Bush called it addiction. So, but it's an addiction to oil that we have. We need 20 million barrels a day in the United States. We produce 13 here, and maybe that'll overcome, or that'll help bring prices down, and which I do agree. Hey, it's anything helps, and anything that helps that keeps prices down, that's a great thing. So there's no problem with us. It's not the kind of crude that we produce in the United States. It's a heavier crude, so we are going to need that crude in our refineries here in the United States, because we've oversupplied our refineries here in the United States. Plus, California knocks them all off all the time, so they're shutting down refineries, and it's a whole different story, a whole different episode for the Sean Sullivan show. But
give me a short version here. Like, explain. Here comes Venezuela versus, you know, West Texas Intermediate or whatever. Let's uh-huh. look at Venezuela yeah. crude. How much more money or more time is it to turn that into the products we need, petroleum versus some WTI?
Yeah, well, Sean, first let me start off. I mean, they're producing about 1 million barrels a day over in Venezuela. They're down from 2.5 to 3 million. So they're producing 1 million, 1.1 million a day. They need some. They're exporting some. You know, to the United States, it could make a small difference. I mean, like I said, we need 20 million barrels a day. If they're producing, you know, 200-300 that they could allocate for the United States, that's great. But now, what everybody's hoping is that we'll just go in there and start producing, you know, 5 to 10 million barrels a day and just help us out a lot, which that's not going to happen. John, only on Landman, only on the show Landman, Cooper and Billy Bob Thornton can drill 6 wells by dinner.
Yeah, that's, you know, what like I did want to get your opinion on that, too, before this Venezuela things came up. But the fact that they can strike it, and I watched that show, and I go, I wonder what Jay thinks of that show.
Oh, you're not the only one. I get a lot of, even my wife will ask me to, okay, stop it, pause it, what's going on here, you know, type things. But, Venezuela is going to be a great place. They say there's 300 billion barrels of oil over there. They say that it's going to help out a lot, but you don't have the infrastructure. You've got to get rigs in there to drill for oil and gas. You've got to get people to drill the wells. I mean, you've got to have a completion. You know, you could take 2 rigs over there and a completion frac crew over there and start producing that oil, and that would help a lot. But you're not going to make a big difference. You know what I'm saying? It's like wells committed 1,000, 2,000 barrels a day. They decline rapidly. So to get up to a big difference and overtake, you know, our deficit. Mm-hmm. We need 20 million a day in the United States. We need 20 million. We produce 7 million. To overtake that, you would need, you know, a plethora of rigs, you know, and you'd have to do some landman magic, you know, to drill a lot of wells in a short amount of time to overtake and make a huge difference. It is going to make a difference, but you know, the world needs 100 million barrels of oil a day. 100 million. They produce a million.
Yeah.
So not that big a deal.
Well, okay, and I'm going to come back to Venezuela's supply. But the quality or lack thereof of Venezuelan oil, is it more like when you bring that in, let's say it comes into that refinery, is it, and you get some WTI coming in to refinery A, and then refinery B gets the Venezuelan oil. Is the production time to get that process longer or more expensive with the Venezuelan oil?
Yeah, but right now we're not even using our refineries. We're sending overseas oil out of the United States to make it into, you know, the less expensive crude that we have, because we can't produce it here. We can't refine it here because of our refineries. So to do that, it just costs more money. So yeah, it'll be more expensive. And you need that type of oil. You need that type of oil to make sure that you can, you know, put those in our refineries here. And it's a great deal. I mean, it's going to work out and it's going to help. But our demand for oil, that's what I look at too. I look at not only the supply that we're going to have, but also look at the demand. So I'll say, hey, you know what? We're going to need more oil every day. The demand, or what I say is the peak oil demand. When are we going to start needing less oil in the United States? And you know, EIA, Goldman, all the people just keep knocking that number out further, which means that we're not going to go down in demand. Demand for oil is going to be around for a long period of time. We're going to need more oil. So therefore, you know, yeah, we're going to need more oil, and we're not producing it here. Right now we're using less rigs in the Permian to drill for oil and gas. We are not only using less rigs to drill for oil and gas, but also the wells that we have online are declining. So we're going to need a big demand here, you know, coming to this summer, next and end of the year, and going into 2027, we're not going to have as much oil in the United States. We're just not drilling it like we were, you know, 2 years ago. And when Trump said, drill, baby, drill.
Yeah, what happened? You know, why aren't we drill, baby, and drilling?
Yeah, well, the price is going down, and the shale, you know, the S-H-A-L-E shale wells that you have to frack, the break-evens are so expensive that a lot of people shut down and they're like, well, we're not going to drill these things at 50, 60 bucks. We'll just hold on to our acreage. And when prices go back around, and this is cyclical, just like everything, when it comes back around, they'll drill it at 70 or 80, but they're not going to drill it at 50, 60, 70. And Everybody thinks the price are going to continue to go down, which, hey, they could. They may continue to go down for a short amount of time, but by next summer, we're going to see, we'll see 70, 75, 80 bucks without question, because we just don't have the oil in the United States.
And that's
we're not going to have it.
Yeah, something for all of us to think about, too, as consumers, that there is a point, I mean, this doesn't magically appear, that gasoline prices, well, as a driver and a consumer, I like to see them come down, but they get to a certain point where the volume of production will go down because there's not the people are going to sit on that reserve. They don't have to sell it right then.
Right, right. Yeah, so you're right. And so what happens is it's cyclical, and it's, I'm a fourth generation guy, and I wrote my book, you know, The Upside of Oil and Gas Investing. Which I believe I sent you a copy. Did I send you a copy?
Got it on my bookshelf. Absolutely.
Good. There you go. Good.
So,
and I'd like to send others to a copy of the book if you go to the website. We'll talk about that in a minute when we're closing out. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you do need a lot of oil in the United States, and it's just a tug of war. You know, OPEC says, oh, we're going to put 1.5 million barrels on the market. We're going to oversupply the United States, and then all of a sudden they go, oh yeah, hey, well, we're just kidding. We're not going to give you 1.5 million, and so they're trying to play that price too because they make money. Their countries make money on oil and gas. I mean, they're nationalized, so therefore that's how they make their money. And the more money they make, the more, I don't know, gold cars they can build or whatever they do
well,
over there.
Okay, but let's talk Venezuela with less quality, but the volume, you kind of mentioned that for a second. I mean, people have said that Venezuelan oil reserves may be the biggest of any nation. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what they're saying. And I don't know how they verified it. And we were having a conversation earlier this morning just talking about, is that true? I don't know how do you make sure when you have a dictatorship, you have that unselling of a country, make sure they're telling the truth. I don't know.
I don't think it's possible. So, right. I mean, they boast about all kind of stuff. I don't know that. For sure, that's going to be accurate with the amount of oil they have there. But, I mean, how do you take this? You take this oil that they have. We know it's a lot. I don't know if it's most or not. That's just what they're saying. But they have a lot. Fail with it. It seems like at a certain point, a country should thrive. I mean, look at the Middle East, right? I mean, the standards of living and all that are so high because it's propped up with all this natural resource of oil. And here's Venezuela.
Right.
And at one point they were living right with it, but is it as simple, even if it's a socialist country, wouldn't you just say, we got to get, hey, socialists out there, we got to do it for the home country. Let's get the production up here. I mean, it would lift everybody.
Right. Yeah, 100%. And the country makes money for the oil anyway, so why wouldn't you get it up to 2-3? They had up to 2.5 to 3 million barrels at one time. Then they quit drilling. There was underinvestment. They just didn't know what they were doing. Oil went down to 1 million, and they're still making money at 1 million. You know, I don't know how much money they're making, but they're still making money. I'm assuming at 1 million barrels. But why not get it to 2 to 3?
Exactly.
You get more oil than anywhere else, and it just takes a lot. It's not as easy as it seems to get a country up to that. You know, because you have so many different. The oil and gas business is so complicated, but it's not. But I can imagine going into a country like Venezuela and bringing rigs in and all the money, because every barrel of oil is sold goes into the Venezuela's pockets. So it's like that's their checkbook.
Yeah. You know? So wouldn't you want your checkbook to have more checks in it? Like, if we could, and I'm not asking for a landman miracle, but they've had 20 years of this. Hey, let's, we let production go to 1 million. Hey, guys, let's just try to get to 2 million. Let's get to work on this. Yeah. Even if it wasn't American or sell out to, you know, other producers, say, but this is what we're getting off every barrel. You know, we're going to make more money. We're going to double our money.
Exactly. A million times 50 or $60 a barrel. Let's say 1 million times 60. Times 30, that's $2 billion a month. $2 billion a month that they have at their disposal. 1 million barrels a day. Why not take that to 2 million, 3 million? What do you have to give up? I don't know. I'm not in those boardrooms and I don't want to be in those boardrooms, but I don't want to. But I'd love to have the opportunity to make that kind of money with oil and gas production, because you're. But I mean, they run their whole government off of that two billion a month. Not to say I couldn't, but of course I could. But I'm just saying that that's a lot of money, and why not? And if you have the reserves, which you're saying, you're claiming you have more oil in your country than Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Iran, Iraq, every country, and they say there's 20% of the total reserves of oil in Venezuela. I don't understand it, but I tell you what, I would be doing. I'd be hiring me a bunch of Billy Bobs to go out there and let's take this thing up. I'm like you, Sean. Let's take this to 2 to 3 million barrels and live large.
Yeah, if you're having trouble.
Have a great country.
Yeah, if you're having trouble keeping the books, you know what they you say at companies I work for, gross cures all. Right? I mean, you get the gross up and cures all. Instead of when it comes to budgeting time, just get the gross up and everything works itself out. You know, you,
100%.
Jay, you mentioned a price per barrel. And I know in conversations we've had in the past, let's look back here domestically, where that, I say sweet spot, because I see the business from a bigger side. I am, like I said, a consumer who fills up the 36-gallon tank on my Ford, but the price where there's incentive for production and American jobs in there, and it's healthy and robust, and people are going to, like you said, take those risks out there, but I'm not paying $5 a gallon. What is that price per barrel? Where is that sweet spot?
Yeah. Well, and I will go back to Billy Bob Thornton and on Landman, because he says $78 a barrel, and that's good. I think it may be a little too high, but because it's, you know, I don't like high prices, but you want to make sure that you're not overdoing it, or it's like, you know, when you see prices that are too high, that you get everybody in the world. I mean, I ran into a friend of mine that was in, he was in real estate, and then I was flying to Midland on a Southwest flight when oil prices were $80-$90 a barrel. And I said, hey, what's going on? What are you going to Midland for? I thought you were in real estate. He played football at college and the NFL. And then I said, what are you doing now? And he goes, I work for an oil and gas company. I said, I just don't understand that. I just think that people that grow up in the oil business or that go into the oil business out of college are the people that are supposed to be in the oil business. Not somebody that goes, oh, okay, here's, I'm looking at the oil business because of, or whatever. That's just kind of how I think. But, so I'm a fourth generation, you know, my granddad went into the oil business when he was 16 years old, you know, and moved to East Texas in 1936. And I mean, it's like we talk about it all the time about, you know, what happened and how things were, and they would shut towns down. These small towns, when they bring a well in, they wanted to watch the oil come over the derrick. I mean, that was my grandmother, grandfather. I mean, that's how they grew up. They don't do that anymore, you know. But that's just how the history of oil and gas and you know, today it's just so different. But yeah, you need $70-$75 a barrel is healthy. Right now, we're in a growth mode, and I'll write about this too in my. I'm doing a second edition of my book, The Upside of Oil and Gas Investing. So you can get one now. I'd love to send you an autographed copy, or I'll send you one when we get the second edition done. But I'm just thinking about it because it is. There's a good – you want to drill right now for oil and gas. Prices are down. We went by. We're picking up a rig to drill in the Panhandle of Texas. That's a really great area for us up there. And we went to – put in $75 million in equity and hopefully sell for $200 to $300 million. But we are picking up a rig up there, and it's like, okay, we go by the yard, and there's three rigs in the yard not being used. You know, and they have these people that are running around trying to work for their families, and that's a lot different when you go by a yard and there's three rigs in the yard instead of no rigs. If there's no rigs, you can't get a price. It's like, hey, I need a rig. And they go, well, we have all our rigs already being used.
Right.
And you go by that one with three rigs, and they're like, man, I got this rig over here. I got this rig. I got this rig. I mean, what specifications do you need? Because that's when you're negotiating. You know, you're not negotiating when all are being used. And one of the things, Sean, that we've talked about is that, you know, to drill an oil and gas well takes about as many vendors as it does to build a house.
Wow.
You know, because you need cement, you need casing, you need a rig, you need people, you need wireline. I mean, I can go through all the list of things that you need to drill or complete or produce wells, and it does. It takes a lot of different vendors, and if they're busy, it's hard to get prices. But if they're not as busy, then they're like, okay, hey, you sold me that pipe last year at, you know, when prices were down, you know, at $8, I needed it at $7 or something, and they're like, yeah, I've got some. Or it's all negotiable. Everything's negotiable. It's not just a one size fits all, like some people may think.
Yeah, it's business, and even when you're dealing with oil and natural gas, remind folks too if they want to get the book. I know you can find your book like in stores and on Amazon and all that, but do you is that best or going to your website? What do you do?
Yeah, it goes to my website. If you want to download it, if you like an autograph, if you're interested in looking at oil and gas as an investment, or if you're investing in oil and gas, or if you have that idea, you need to buy my book, because I talk about a lot about, you know, how can investors get taken advantage of, and what's a good deal, what's not a good deal. So if you're interested in that, go to my website, kingoperating.com, and fill out the information and say, hey, I'm interested in an autographed copy of Jay's book. I'd be glad to send it to you. Or if you're just like, I want to learn oil gas and what goes on behind the scenes, and what about Jay Young's family? You can go to anywhere and buy the book yourself. Whichever one, we welcome it. And I give all the money to charity for the book, so I'm not making any money off of it. And I love to, always love helping the military.
Well, it's good stuff. It's good read, too, for people to check out. And, yeah, in the second edition, just point out that Cooper can't drill that many wells in a day, okay?
He definitely will be mentioned. Definitely will be mentioned.
Jay, man, great to talk to you again, and we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. John, Happy New Year. Talk to you soon.
Happy New Year. There he goes, the one and only Jay Young, and we'll be right back. More Midday Mobile.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 12:56, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Thank you to Jay. Always good to get him on the show. Yep. Coming up, hour number two. Don't want to miss this. Steve Hutchinson is going to join us, part of that lawsuit against Mobile County and Boss over the county's vacation of the road that led there to the only public launch on Big Creek Lake. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And I thought this was a good time to remind you about what my buddy Trey does. He got a company, maybe you heard of it, called 1-800-GOT-JUNK. Maybe, just maybe, for your New Year's resolution, you're going to get organized. My pro tip is it's easier to organize fewer things. See what it did? So it sounds like a Confucius said it or something. Easier to organize fewer things. If you got junk around the house, storage unit, shop, you got junk that's, you're like, oh, we'll get around to getting that stuff gone, get rid of it now or pretty soon when you make an appointment with 1-800-GOT-JUNK. And that's what I love too, that Trey gets it. None of this stuff where you have to sit all day and wait for some person you're paying to come to your house. They find out the day you want to do it, the time you want to do it. They make a good old-fashioned appointment. And then all you got to do when they get there is point at the junk you want gone. It can be big stuff, too. Don't just think boxes. I mean, they remove, you know, above-ground pools and trampolines and storage buildings and the contents and all that stuff. If that's in your way, they can handle that as well. But make the call. The name is the number, 1-800-GOT-JUNK, or go to the website, 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. Make that appointment and get your New Year's resolution done and started today when you make that appointment with 1-800-GOT-JUNK. All right, coming back, hour number two of Midday Mobile.